This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Adam Sandler, is famous for his comedy films and his work on Saturday Night Live in the 90s. But he's also given some terrific performances in dramas. He stars in the new manic thriller Uncut Gems, which was written and directed by the Safdie brothers, Josh and Benny Safdie, who are also with us. Sandler plays Howard Ratner, a jeweler in Manhattan's Diamond District who always has a deal or a con going on and never stops talking. And he's a gambler. He's made a lot of money and lost a lot of money and is deep in debt to a loan shark whose men are after him. He's trying to talk and gamble his way out of the predicament he's in. The Safdie's father worked in the Diamond District when they were kids, and they heard a lot of stories. Uncut Gems won the Best Director Award from the New York Film Critics Circle, the National Board of Review gave Sandler the Best Actor Award, and the Safdie brothers the Best Screenplay Award. The film has 5 nominations from the Independent Spirit Awards, including Best Feature, Director, Screenplay, and Male Lead. Here's a scene from Uncut Gems, with Howard, Sandler's character, placing bets with his bookie on the Boston Celtics and player Kevin Garnett.
What do you want? I already made your bet.
I know. I got to change the bet. I got $21,000 here. So you add it on to the 19 grand. It's $40,000 in all.
Scrap the whole bet?
Scrap the whole bet. I want to make a 6-way parlay. Celtics, Sixers game. What's the line?
Still plus one.
Plus one. Okay, so I want the Celtics to cover. I want the Celtics halftime. I want Garnett points and rebounds. Garnett block shots. Celtics opening tip. Do you take lightning bets?
Yeah, but you don't want any part of lightning bets.
Fine.
Come on.
$1,000 a point. Okay, take this. And this is a gift for me.
What's this?
Just tolerating me for all this time, okay?
No. I already have a Rolex. I don't need your watch. Listen, it probably fell off a truck anyway. Listen, but what do you know? Gone at this, gone at that. What do you know?
I don't know. I just know.
Well, I'll tell you what I know. That's the dumbest bet I ever heard of.
I disagree.
Adam Sandler and Josh and Benny Safdie, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the film and the awards
so
and
much.
Nominations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
So I'm going to ask one of the Safdie brothers first, and you can decide which one takes this, to describe the character Adam Sandler plays. I've already given a basic introduction, but give us your take on the character.
Howard is an optimist. He's a nauseating optimist. He's a.k.a. a gambler. He's a dreamer. He's a guy who wants to return to his place at the table that he fought so hard to eat at. And, you know, the movie's taking place at a time in his life where he's trying to parlay everything to get that triumphant moment again.
Mm-hmm. And he's a little tough, you know, he won't back down, you know, he's not settled in his place, you know, he wants to go bigger.
Howard is in the tradition of the great 20th century Jews who we stood for so much to us, the Rodney Dangerfields, the Lenny Bruces, the Al Goldsteins, the Borscht Belt community who were able to, from the outside, look at life and wryly comment on it all the time and in particular, most importantly, Rodney Dangerfield. Dangerfield was huge for us.
And then there's also the Adam Sandlers, you know, who are huge.
Why did you think of Adam Sandler for the role?
There really, in our heads, there was nobody else. You know, there was only one person who we knew could ground absurd situations in total reality. You know, in all of his films, when you're watching them, you truly believe what's going on is happening to him. It's an incredible skill. And for this, you'd really need to root for Howard for the whole movie to work. And he brings such a humor and just a presence nobody else could do it.
It's tough speaking about him in front of him right now.
I'm not looking.
it's Sandler has a, you know, Adam, you got a really, really unique thing going on in life. And, you know, you have a way of making people, you know, making characters, like Benny said, ground these absurd characters, making them lovable and giving a soul behind the eyes of the characters. And it's just, I don't know what it is. It's something ineffable. It's seeing the desire and the struggle behind the eyes to get at something great. And that exists in your real life. And you want to be overwhelmed by something great all the time that you get lost.
And okay, you have to love Howard.
Let me bring Adam Sandler in. Adam Sandler.
We could talk about him all day.
Yeah, this is nice.
Don't get us started.
Terry, you shouldn't interrupt that kind of thing.
Yeah, sorry about that. So
thank you.
When they offered you the role, Did you initially want it? Did you see yourself as this character, Howard?
Well, I saw Howard. I wasn't sure I could do it. Their passion was strong about Howard and about the movie. And my first instinct is I'm scared because I don't want to let these guys down, because I could feel how great of a piece it was when I read it. And then also, you know, I do have a wife. I do have kids. I get nervous about even pretending to be a bad guy. I get nervous about that and how it could affect my household and stuff like that. So I'm a little bit nuts like that. I don't think that's the way you should think in life, but this is kind of what I do think. And initially, I saw their other movies, the Safdie brothers, and just realized that these guys are doing something exceptional and new and had their own voice. And I knew it would be something great, and I'd feel like I'd miss out on something if I didn't do it. And my wife read the script, and she was like, "You just have to do this. This movie's incredible." And as an actor, how are you ever going to see a part where you get to do these many emotions and ups and downs and go through as much as this guy is going through? And so once my wife, you know, we were in the same house, she gives me the go-ahead, it just makes life feel much easier, and I jump in hard.
Thank you, Jackie.
What were your fears about the effect this character would have on your family before your wife said, "This is a great opportunity, you should do the film"?
I think I just, you know, I probably think about having to be this guy and the day and the actual scene we're shooting, and just, I'm really... I love being with my family a lot. I love being with my and being a part of their day. And I don't know, it just messes your head up sometimes when you're deep in a character and you're just present for that and doing things that you wouldn't do in real life to your family. And I don't know, maybe it's I shouldn't be an actor if I talk like this, but I do screw my head up until I got the go ahead, and then I'm good. I just am very connected with my wife, and we like to feel comfortable and with each other and give each other back each other up kind of thing. So I guess you know, and then also there's that my kids are going to see this movie someday, and I know it. If I saw my father go through what this guy goes through, I probably would mess my head up. So, you know, I overthink it, but this is how I was thinking.
What did you do to physically take on the character? Like, you're wearing false teeth, you have clothes right. That you don't typically wear. Why did, and maybe this is a question for the Safdies too, why did you need false teeth?
That was these guys. They came up with that.
I think that we spent 10 years working on this movie, including going out to Sandler's team 10 years ago and getting the no.
Strong no. Pass, buddy.
Get better.
It was actually worse than that. It was just silence.
just get better and come back to us. With a movie like this, and with every movie really that we work on, you have to. There's the journalistic component of doing your research and doing getting to know the world firsthand and from a primary source. You being the primary source, and I saw a lot of. It was a status symbol. A lot of a lot of jewelers, a lot of people we came across in that world, you know, cap their teeth as a status thing. So it was, you know, everything kind of comes from character and character biography.
Yeah, and we had seen there's a documentary by Nick Broomfield, Heidi Fleiss, the
Hollywood Madam,
and there's this character Yvonne Nage, and he's just got this smile. And it's infectious. And at any moment, he turns it on, even in the worst situations. And it was so interesting. And I don't know. And then we tried it out. We did a bunch, 5 months before we were shooting, we did a bunch of tests just to see how these things would feel. And
helped a lot. It helps just knowing I'm not Adam Sandler in the part. It's just that they gave me a mole. They gave me my hair was different. My glasses helped. The earrings helped, and the clothes being so different, it just helped me definitely dive into a different person.
Terry, in the beginning, actually, the initial impetus was, we thought, let's really try to camouflage Sandler as much as possible, so that when we were doing the research in the Diamond District, because we did it with Sandler in particular, we did it together. We wanted to see, can we take this fictional character and stand him up against reality, and will it stand that test? And it did. The first few times we went to the block, no one recognized you, and you were just kind of, it allowed you to be more like a sponge, and malleable, and
right.
So there was a pragmatism in it as well.
How did it feel to not be recognized, Adam?
Well, that would last maybe 40 seconds, but it felt neat. It felt neat. I like sitting back and watching and learning from everybody. I these jewelers on 47th Street, that the Safdie boys and Ronnie, who also wrote the movie, and they were so excited about us making a movie about the block. They led us into their lives. They taught us so many things, so many thoughts that go through their head while they're selling, and their day-to-day family life, and had a it was great to not be recognized, kind of sit there and spy on them.
Adam Sandler, you found the voice for this character. This character is mm-hmm. a fast talker. He's always trying to convince people or sell people on something. He's just always taking mm-hmm. chances. He always mm-hmm. says things he can't really back up. And he doesn't stop talking.
Yes.
You found the rhythm and you found the music in that character's voice.
Right.
Can you describe finding the voice and what that voice is?
Well, that voice is, was written. And then also we after getting to meet a bunch of guys on the block, there were certain aspects of certain guys I met that I would think of their rhythms and how they talked and how they I'll tell you, I think in my head Howard talks a lot, not only to, he just wants control when he wants to control the what we're talking about, because I don't think he likes sitting and thinking too much. I think he likes hitting, and he's a very sensitive guy. He's sensitive to what everyone's thinking in the room, so he takes care. He's talking to one person dead on, and then he hears something going on the right. He makes sure and take care of that situation, includes everybody. It's a guy who likes to run the room. And so that's why he's just hypersensitive. It's, to me, very stand-up comedian-like. When you're on stage and you're performing at a little club, and you're telling your jokes, and the 10 people in front of you laugh, but the guy on the left doesn't laugh, you'll see most comedians will go over to the guy who's not laughing and try to include him in a certain way, and I feel Howard's mm-hmm. sort of like that. Mm-hmm.
Totally.
The movie is so much about speed. You know, the Howard character is really manic. The neighborhood in Manhattan is really chaotic and kind of manic. Mm-hmm. And Howard has to make a lot of money really quickly to pay off his debts. And the speed of the movie is manic. I mean, I'm almost imagining you there with stopwatch saying, okay, 90 seconds, the scene is over, time for another scene.
Wow.
I mean, there's so many different scene shots in it. It's like it's constantly changing to a new scene or a new location, or there's an edit, because everything is just constantly manic. And I want you to talk a little bit about creating that nonstop energy in the film.
You know, when we were writing the script, we did over 160 drafts over the course of 10 years. And when Scott Rudin got involved as a producer 3 years ago, he was looking at the script and he saw over 160 page script. And he says, Josh, how long do you want this movie to be? And I said, the movie's going to be 90 minutes. And he says, well, how is that possible? It's a 160 page script. I said, it's going to be a 90 minute movie conceptually. And because when we did our research in the Diamond District, It was time turned into something else there, because there was so much happening at once, and there were so many different narratives happening. At one guy had six different deals happening at the same time. When you would do your research there, you'd be 30 minutes in the Diamond District is the equivalent of 7 hours anywhere else. It was exhausting to spend the days there, but exhilarating also. And it was also absurd and thrilling, and there was, you know, even though there was no crime happening, there was a sense of criminality, because you just see these handshake deals, and it was a barbaric world. So everything kind of was informed by that research, yeah, and by that experience, you know. And
then just on set, the way we would kind of work is we would have this. Everybody is allowed to talk. You know, the extras in the background are allowed to talk. Actors are allowed to step on one another. You know, there's no marks, and we don't have playback. So there's this feeling of propulsion of just the scene happening in, yeah, reality. And so then what you kind of, when you come to the edit, you have these amazing moments that you've tried to capture as real, you know, in quotes. And then we start like a documentary and we take the scene from where it was born on the set, and then it kind of takes on a new life and it gets kind of shrink wrapped, and we approach everything with such a sharp knife.
So Josh and Benny Safdie, your father for a few years when you were very young worked in the Diamond District. What did he do?
He was a runner and a salesman. So a runner brings jewelry from one place, like a, you know, a wholesale dispatch, to a jewelry store or a pawn shop. And it started off in the five boroughs, and then when he would go and do these deliveries, he was, you know, a charming guy, and he would end up selling more from the inventory. So then he would come back with memos and slips, and he'd have to go back out, and then he ended up getting this car from the business, and then he would drive around to the tri-state area, and it was a very very thrilling time. And he, you know, actually when we met up with our dad's boss 10 years ago, the first thing he said to us is, your dad owes me $3,000. And the story behind that was that when he was really getting into it with his boss, and he ended up, you know, getting engaged to a woman who worked there, and he, you know, had a big fight with him, and he basically said, I quit. And the guy's like, all right, give me my car back. He's like, well, not until you give me my commissions. And they had a stalemate, and eventually, so our dad was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to find the most expensive garage in New York. I'm going to put the car in that garage. And he told his boss, listen, you know, when you pay me my commissions, I'll tell you where the car is. So when he finally paid him, he gave him the address of where the car was, and it was at this expensive garage, and it was a $3,000 bill to get the car out of the garage.
So Adam Sandler was worried about playing Howard because he thought it would have a bad effect on his family. You wrote and directed this movie inspired by your father's work, in part by his personality, in part by people he knew. Are you not afraid about the impact that this movie is going to have on your father?
Well, it's so different. You know, it's totally fiction. You know, over the 10 years, you know, the three of us, Josh and Ronnie, you know, working on this, it was totally fabricated to the point where you have no idea where the reality is and where it begins. And I think what's interesting is when you watch on the screen, it feels so real.
When we showed our dad the movie, and he was so, I mean, I watched it sitting next to him, and he was so engaged with the film, and he was speaking out loud the entire time. At one point, he pulled out his phone and started to bootleg the movie on his phone. And I told him, I said, what are you doing? Put the phone away. He's like, I'm sorry. I'm so excited. And you know, there's a scene where Howard is in a closet texting with his girlfriend. And my dad just let out. He goes, I love this guy. You know, when the movie finished, he just said, it's R.J. MacReady. It's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He was so in awe. Movies to him are these, you know, is the Socratic method. You know, it's to him, you watch a movie to understand your own life, and it was that. It was like for him, his kids had made this thing, this Titanic thing, a movie, you know, with a capital M, and it was that was amazing. And I think that he's, since he was a kid, he's gotten totally lost in movies. And, you know, he showed us movies a lot when we were kids and asked us to find answers in them. So it was, in short, Terry, no, yeah, we're not. But he's, you know, he was really mesmerized by the movie, which was awesome to kind of see.
What did your father do after he left the Diamond District?
He worked for American Express briefly. And then he worked as a graphic designer. Then he worked as a web person. Then he worked as an ice cream shop manager. Then he worked as a Briefly with a gas station thing. Yeah. It's real. Then he worked. He's had real estate, a fish. He sold fish for a long time. I mean, he's had a lot of jobs.
Got it. All right.
the idea of showing movies to understand was a big one. You know, it's like at one point when our parents they were divorced and there was a whole thing going on. He's like, okay, you're about to go back to your mom. I'm going to show you guys Kramer versus Kramer. And he's like, I'm Dustin Hoffman.
And it was
like,
and your mom is Meryl Streep.
So it was like, when we got to our moms, she's like, why are you guys so angry at me right now? And then we told her why. And he's stretching and he's bending reality to his own wishes, you know, to get what he wants.
All right. Well, congratulations on the awards and the nominations. Adam Sandler, Josh and Benny Safdie, thank you so much for coming to our show.
Thank you for having us, Terry.
Adam Sandler stars in Uncut Gems. Josh and Benny Safdie co-wrote and directed the film. As each year comes to an end, our critic at large, John Powers, invariably regrets all the things he was not able to cover. And so he makes what he calls his ghost list of the best things he saw, read, or listened to, but somehow never reviewed.
Few things haunt a critic more than loving something and not being able to share it. Every year I wind up being plagued by the hungry ghosts of the things I wasn't able to review. Dog-eared books, dust-covered DVDs, TV shows and songs that rattle the windows of my playlists. Each December, I try to placate them with this ghost list before time runs out. Fittingly, I begin with an artist whose work draws much of its wonder from otherworldly spirits. I'm talking of Hayao Miyazaki, the 78-year-old Japanese who's the greatest animated filmmaker alive. Over the last year or so, G-Kids has been bringing out fabulous collector's editions of his best films on Blu-ray and DVD. You still can't stream them. Miyazaki doesn't do brash American animation, with parrots voiced by comedians and bushels of pop culture jokes. Often beginning with childhood pain or anxiety, he taps into deep psychic wells and Japanese folklore to conjure worlds that teem with invention. Like the 12-legged cat that's a bus in the beloved My Neighbor Totoro, or the enigmatic amusement park of his masterpiece, Spirited Away, whose 10-year-old heroine is plunged into a wonderland as slippery and surreal as Lewis Carroll. Watching Miyazaki, you enter a realm of pure imagination. Things are distressingly real in Netflix's Unbelievable, a series based on a true story about the victims and pursuers of a serial rapist. It begins with a young Washington State woman, Marie, played by Caitlin Dever, whose life collapses when male cops bully her into retracting a claim she's been raped. Then, 2 years later outside Denver, a series of identical rapes start being committed, and two female cops from different cities, that's Merritt Weaver and Toni Collette, realize they may be chasing the same man. Here they've just met, and Collette's character starts explaining what her perp did.
He proceeds to rape her for 3 hours, on and off. I mean,
same thing with my victim. Stopping and starting for 4 hours.
Huh. Well, after he did the shower thing, by the time she gets out, he's gone. Took her sheets, her pillow,
yeah,
blankets.
Same with mine. He left a scene so clean you could eat off it.
My team searched every dumpster within a 2-mile radius, every trash can. They scoured ditches. We dragged a pond, hoping to find something. The gun, her sheets, or...
No luck.
Nada. I mean, I got a few leads from the neighbors. A cable guy, some folks thought was a bit creepy. Which he was, but he's a cable guy, so... Anyway, he checked out. There were a few other shifty dudes, some with assault records, but I just cleared the last one yesterday, so...
Unbelievable unfolds slowly and methodically and without melodrama. Its 8 episodes not only take the time to show the cost of sexual assault on its victims, but the show's deliberateness only heightens the ironic sting of the series' title. What's truly unbelievable isn't Marie's story about being raped, but how she's not listened to by those supposedly there to protect her. There are, of course, other ways that women are ignored. Take the case of Nancy Hale, a hugely acclaimed short story writer from the 1930s to 60s. She had 80 stories published in The New Yorker. But like many women artists, her work seemed to vanish into the ether. I'd never even heard of her until the invaluable Library of America brought out Where the Light Falls, a collection of her stories chosen and introduced by Lauren Groff. Recalling writers like Virginia Woolf and John Cheever, Hale's stories tackle many topics, from unwanted pregnancy to the fear of nukes. They usually center on characters who must come to terms with ways of living unlike their own, like the young man who prefers the earthy honesty of Finnish immigrants to his own prosperous family, or the abandoned wife who discovers her affinities with a Jewish escapee from the Holocaust. If Hale is a great rediscovery, one of 2019's great arrivals is Mati Diop, a Senegalese-French filmmaker who became the first black woman to have a film in competition at Cannes. It's titled Atlantics, you can see it on Netflix, and boy, is it a terrific debut. Set on the outskirts of Senegal's capital, Dakar, this sensuously photographed movie starts off seeming like a romantic tale about a young woman, Ada, engaged to a smug rich guy, but secretly in love with construction worker, Suleiman. But after Suleiman sets off on a ship in search of work, everything changes. We grasp that we're actually in a magical realist ghost story that's also a political movie about poverty, immigration, and women's freedom. Reminiscent of moody, poetic horror films like Cat People and I Walked with a Zombie, Atlantics ushers you into a mysterious new world. I also loved being ushered into the not-so-old world of 1969 Los Angeles in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Quentin Tarantino's movie itself has no cause to wail from neglect, but I do want to say a few words in praise of the well-curated musical soundtrack. Rather than wallpaper the movie with iconic hits, the cuts from the likes of Deep Purple, Buffy St. Marie, and Paul Revere in The Raiders perfectly serve Tarantino's vision. They offer a somewhat skewed version of a famous year. The payoff comes with the Rolling Stones' Out of Time, a track about kissing off an old girlfriend. We're used to songs being repurposed in degrading ways. Just think of that Amazon commercial, which shows ecstatic consumers to the strains of Ave Maria, for crying out loud. Tarantino does the opposite. He takes a song that's not in the Stones' pantheon. Rolling Stone magazine ranks it their 82nd best. But by playing it over the slow build of the climax, he achieves cinematic alchemy. The song deepens the movie's fatal sense of time passing, not only for those menaced by the Manson family, but for an entire era of Hollywood. And the movie deepens the song, uncovering emotional resonances we'd never before noticed. You'll never hear Out of Time the same way again. And with that, it appears that I'm out of time too. So Mick, take it away.
You don't know what's going on. You've been away for far too long. You can't come back and think you are still there. You're out of touch, my baby. My boy just got it, baby. I said, baby, 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 you're out of time. Well, baby, baby.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large. We're going to look back at the year in TV with our TV critic, David Bianculli. Hey, David, I always look forward to this at the end of the year.
Oh, me too.
Okay, so let's start with your 10 best list. Do you want to run through it for us?
So going backwards from number 10 for maximum suspense.
Yes, yeah.
Number 10 is Veep, which ended this year on HBO, had another strong season. Number 9 is CBS's Evil, which premiered this year. It's by the same producers who did The Good Wife and The Good Fight, and they're doing this very strange, spooky, supernatural, religious questioning thing. It's worth seeing. It's really a good show, and it's developing as it's going along. And it's on broadcast television. There aren't that many great shows left on broadcast TV, so it's good to point out that, yes, they can still do drama. Number 8 is Barry on HBO, which just deepens all the time and really good performances and writing. That's a very funny show. Number seven, maybe not a lot of people saw this, but it was on Netflix, called Dead to Me, Christina Applegate and Linda Cardellini, and a very dark but very funny comedy about women who are going through changes in life and reacting to one another, and it really goes in lots of unexpected directions. Number six, which started again this month on Amazon, is The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And so the people who are fans of that show already know about it, and it's back. It's got a good cast and good writing by Amy Sherman Palladino. Number five, Damon Lindelof's show Watchmen on HBO. This is one that has gotten so good so fast that it's sort of taking the place for me of a show that ended this year that I loved because it was so bizarre, and that was Legion, which is also on my top 10 list farther up. But Watchmen is getting so weird. Catch it on streaming now because it's now gone for the season, and its episodes are so smart. Jeremy Irons is in it. It's just Jean Smart. There are so many good performances all the way
Regina
through.
Regina King.
Yes, she's fabulous in this.
Is it coming back?
I'm pretty sure it is. It's in the place right now where like Big Little Lies on HBO was originally thought maybe we'll just do one, but it caught on so big that it came back. So I'm expecting the same of Watchmen. Number four, I'm using the fourth place as a tie for Fleabag on Amazon and Killing Eve on BBC America. They're both created by Phoebe Waller-Bridge. She didn't do the current season of Killing Eve, but it's still her idea. But Fleabag on Amazon surprised almost everybody by winning Emmys this year as Best Comedy, and it's deserved. It's really a good show and a distinct female voice that's great to have on television. Number three is Black Mirror, and that's from Charlie Brooker, and it's the best anthology series since The Twilight Zone, and it just every single year it comes out, other people try to imitate it and fail, showing how hard it is, and Black Mirror just does more really good stories, and that's on Netflix. Legion, I've already mentioned, that was on FX, ended this season. Noah Hawley, it used television better than almost anything since Twin Peaks has used television. And then number one, this is probably going to surprise people because it's another network show. It's from NBC. It's from Michael Schur, and it's The Good Place. It's a comedy about the afterlife.
Like heaven and hell in the afterlife?
It's heaven and hell, and you never know which one is which. It's just so brilliant about the way that it approaches its subject. For example, I brought along a clip, since it's my favorite show of the year, where you have people who have their respective little cadres in what we can call heaven and hell. And Ted Danson is Michael in The Good Place, ostensibly. And then there's a guy, Mark Evan Jackson plays him. He's called Sean, and he's the leader of The Bad Place. And so this opening sequence has both of them. It alternates between them giving pep talks to their respective troops. And in The Bad Place, you get to hear Hell's theme song, and when I heard it, it really made me laugh.
So we're starting with The Good Place, and then we'll go to The Bad Place?
Yes.
Okay.
And marching us into battle, our fearless leader, the pride of Phoenix, Arizona, Eleanor Shellstrop.
Technically, the pride of Phoenix is a life-size statue of Alice Cooper made from cigarette butts. It's outside City Hall. But thank you for the kind words.
With this team, there's no problem we can't solve.
There is no problem we can't create. And believe me, we are going to create some problems. So let's kick things off with our official Bad Place song. 1-877 Cars for Kids. KARS Cars for Kids.
Ooh, are we singing?
Shut up, Glenn.
I love that. That Cars for Kids commercial, I honestly
I
feel like
it.
It's stalking me.
I know.
It follows me around when I watch TV. Then on satellite radio, I hear it too. It drives me crazy.
Me too. And when I heard this on The Good Place, I really did one of those super laugh out louds because I thought, oh my gosh, Michael Shore understands. He hears the same bad song as many times as I do, and he thinks it comes straight from hell, and he could be right.
Well, good. Okay, so David, your top 10 list. Thank you for presenting that. So hearing your top 10 list, of course, I can't help but notice that four of the shows were from streaming services. You've got Black Mirror, Fleabag, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and Dead to Me. And
oh, yeah, that's right.
And so the way things are going now, it's funny, like we're living in an era so many people have cut the cord to cable and they're not paying for TV. But now in order to watch shows, you have to subscribe a la carte, not to cable, but to the streaming services. So let's talk about how they're developing. We've got new ones that we didn't even have before.
Right.
And the old ones are just getting bigger and bigger. Let's start with Disney because they're such a new entry.
Yes.
And they're so big.
Disney Plus is, to me, inescapable. You've got the Disney backlog of movies and TV stuff. You would think that would be enough to keep a new streaming service alive. But they also have the Star Wars universe. They also have the Marvel universe. They also have the Muppets. They have Pixar.
How did they get all that?
Just by, you know, marching across Europe and taking over territories. They just spent a lot of money. What's happening with all of these streaming services who are going for global domination is that they are spending the money as fast as they can. I mean, you look at Netflix, for example, which led the territory here. It used to say, we've got an original show, and then we'll have another one in 6 months. And so that was its pace. Now you get six or seven shows from Netflix every Friday. And so what everybody's doing is spending money and then making as much of their own stuff exclusive or buying it exclusively. So the Disney movies that used to be, or some of these Star Wars properties or Marvel movies that used to be available on Netflix or elsewhere, they've drawn back. So they're now exclusively on one service. So if you want to see those, you've got to get Disney Plus.
What do they charge? I mean, what are we up against financially?
Well, almost all of these, it's going to be like $5 a month, or if you don't want to have commercial interruptions, then it's going to be $10 a month. You can basically sort of round it out to $10 per month per streaming service. And if you think
that's a lot of money.
Yes, it is. And if you think that on my top 10 this year alone, you had Netflix, you had Amazon, so that's two that you got to get just to get some of the.
That's $20 a month right there.
Right. And then Hulu had Handmaid's Tale and The Act and some other things. And so you start adding them. And then you had Apple TV Plus was another new one this year. And it just keeps going. It's the same problem as when cable started in the 70s.
What was that problem with
cable? The problem was everybody wanted to get on board, but separately. And so all of a sudden, consumers were paying more than they wanted to for cable. So the corporations began bundling up. And so you could get a premium sports bundle or an entertainment bundle or a news bundle. And then things would drop by because they wouldn't get enough support on cable companies. Streaming, it's all there at once. So it's totally dependent upon whether they can create an appetite from the viewer.
Let's talk about another new entry in this field, and that's Apple TV Plus. How are they defined in terms of the programming?
Well, they don't have a backlog. Their stuff is all original. They're saying, you're coming to us for the new stuff, and we've got this morning show with Jennifer Aniston, and we've got this different sort of thing that's kind of like Game of Thrones. But they don't have much. The one thing that I've been impressed by is M. Night Shyamalan's The Servant, which is written by other people. He's directed a couple. It's a good horror series, but I don't think that's what it wants to be known as, you know, at Apple. So I don't think they have a clear identity yet.
With Netflix, like, they are doing movies as well as TV shows.
Oh, my head hurts.
Yeah.
I know.
And I mean, so The Irishman and Marriage Story, two of the really acclaimed movies of the year, are Netflix films. There's probably others too, but those are current ones. I have to say, with The Irishman, I made a point of getting to the movie theater because I thought it's 3.5 hours and I want to just be in a dark room with it, because I was really afraid if I watched it at home that there'd be so many distractions.
What was it like for you? Because I watched it at home.
I saw it in the theater, and I liked it a lot, and I was really glad I was in the theater. I think I wouldn't have been as immersed in it had I watched it at home. And it's a kind of complicated plot, and I have a feeling if I watched it at home, I'd keep rewinding it and going like, oh, who was that guy who was just shot? and like, I'd never make it through, whereas in the movie theater, it goes by, you go, okay, I didn't quite get that. I can live with that.
And I'm glad it held up for you at that pace in the theaters.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and there's a lot I liked about the film.
Okay.
But that's not to say you wouldn't enjoy it at home if you're thinking of watching it at home.
I personally recommend it. Because I did.
Yeah.
But I just, that's the reason it's not on my top 10,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
is because I consider it a movie.
So how has Netflix been evolving? Because it's one of the streaming services that really established streaming as an important player.
It used to be saying, we will do things of quality that will get us noticed. And then they just started saying, we will do things of quantity, and some of them will be quality. And now they're saying, we will do things in more than one arena. And so there's no reason, they figured, with all the money they have, that they couldn't make movies as well as original television productions. And they get a double dip that way. They get to go into the movie stream and do box office and maybe go for Oscars. And then they get the first rights to it. It's something else exclusive to them, so that when you say, what streaming service am I going to hang on to? It's like, oh, well, look, this movie that was in theaters that I didn't see, I can only see here. It's all Machiavellian and it's all scary.
What are the TV networks doing to maintain relevance during this period?
Not enough. I mean, really not enough. The networks know that they can rely on, it used to be, news and sports would be live. That would be it. But you think of CBS and NBC and ABC, and they're not the news presence that they used to be. I don't know, and it's not a fair question to ask you, and I don't even think it's a fair question to ask me, to identify the network anchors of the evening newscasts at CBS, NBC, and ABC. A generation ago...
You know, I've been thinking about that too, David.
Yeah.
You know, I, for myself, I watch the news channels a lot.
Yeah.
I'm not home when the network news is on, but even if I was, I'd probably have one of the news channels on.
It's exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But I am watching more news than I ever have.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not watching a lot of it on the broadcast networks.
You know, we were talking about how fragmented the TV audience is now, mm-hmm. because you've got networks, you've got cable, you've got all these new streaming services, and each service, well, some of the services have so many shows. And because of that fragmentation, the TV audience is so divided. And as you acknowledge, some of the shows on your 10 best list, some of our audience will have never heard of.
Right.
Because the audience is so fragmented. But it seems like the main characters in our culture now, the characters that everybody knows, are the people in politics. Like, everybody doesn't know who's on Fleabag, even though that's a great show, but everybody knows who Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi and Rudy Giuliani and Adam Schiff are. So, you know, politics is what we're disagreeing on, but it's also what we're all talking about.
It's a great comparison, because we're disagreeing about it in part because our politics and our news are so fragmented. It didn't used to be that way. We watched all the same news at the same time, pretty much. And now you go to your respective corners and watch your preferred interpretation of whatever happened that day. I, as a TV critic, bounce around. So I'll watch CNN, I'll watch MSNBC, I'll watch Fox News. And every time I complete that lap, I have a really horrible headache because I see how little commonality there is. And I think all the time, most people don't see that.
Because they're not watching all three.
They're not watching all three. They're not watching what Fox News is not saying that MSNBC is, and vice versa, and not covering. It's tricky. I don't know how we escape from this.
While you're here,
mm-hmm.
why don't you recommend a few shows that are on streaming or on demand that, you know, or is it like a limited series that people can binge and catch up on, something manageable?
All right. I'll start with TV movies, two of them, Deadwood the movie on HBO and El Camino, a Breaking Bad movie on Netflix. So if you loved those series that have been gone for a while, it's a chance to go back and see the newest episode 10 years later or whatever. And they're both wonderful. Hulu and Amazon both this year have unearthed for the first time the complete showings of one series from the 70s, Lou Grant, and one series from the 80s, Saint Elsewhere, that have never been out on home video.
I'm going to throw in one.
Okay.
Because I binged on this, I guess, a year ago, 2 years ago. I lose track of time.
That's fun.
But
I can't wait to hear what this is.
Okay, it's Godless. If you like Westerns.
Oh, yes.
As I do. But it's this really charismatic Western that it has really strong women in it, really charismatic men. It's fabulous. So
that's a great recommendation.
Yeah.
You'll know before the opening credits whether you want to be with this show.
Exactly.
And you should.
Exactly.
That's a good one.
Thank you.
Good for you.
Thank you. Well, it's been great fun to talk with you, David.
I love this. Thanks a lot.
David Bianculli is Fresh Air's TV critic. He's the founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and is a professor of television at Rowan University in New Jersey.